and Namaste Publishing present Living the Liberated Life and Dealing with the Pain Body, Session 2 with Eckhart Tolle.
So the sense of power or aliveness that dwells there, this is where what they talk about in trust, the word trust, trusting in life, to trust. It's hard to make yourself trust when your primordial condition is fear, which is the primordial human condition in the mind-identified state. Fear and trust can't go together. Trust is simply the absence of fear. So you cannot make yourself trust, or even affirmations won't do it. You can even repeat affirmations and put them on your bathroom mirror. I trust in life. I trust that life is supporting me. But eventually you have to go even beyond the affirmation and the trust arises naturally where you actually don't need any more affirmations because you're there, the reality of it is there. Affirmations are maybe a transitional stage when you haven't quite arrived at the reality of it. Then you say, I'm wealthy, but when you have 50 million in the bank, you can take off the affirmation from your bathroom mirror. It's obvious, you know you're wealthy. You don't need to say it anymore. Bill Gates doesn't have the affirmation on his bathroom mirror. And that's only external wealth. No, this is not going to save him. Even with that, he cannot buy peace. But just giving that example to see when the reality is obvious and it's there, then you don't need the signpost anymore because every affirmation is a kind of signpost that points you in the right direction. But there comes a point when the signpost isn't needed anymore because you have arrived. So that the trust, when you feel you go into the inner body, and then there's the first very subtle, and then you feel increasingly more intensely the power, the aliveness, the stillness, and yet the incredible energy behind that. And then you know that is most, on the most fundamental level, that's, I am that. I'm not the little me in the head. And that is going to, that lives and acts through you. That power is there. And when you know yourself as that, that's trust. Then you suddenly, trust is your natural state. No longer something you need to figure out how to get there. Trust is your natural state, so that even the concept trust disappears because it's so natural you don't even have a word for it anymore. Many concepts disappear when the reality that to which the concept points arrives. The very mental concept of it is not really necessary anymore. I rarely talk about love, although I did this morning, but I don't talk about it too often. It arises naturally out of the state of presence. And you don't need to keep the concept in your head and tell yourself that I'm loving a loving being. It's not needed anymore. I sometimes surprised when people tell me things and that, oh, people sometimes, because I'm kind of present, and people say, oh, you're so patient. Oh, I'm so patient? I didn't know I'm patient. I hadn't thought about it as patient. It never occurred to me that I'm patient. I didn't have the whole this concept at all, because patient still means that you're trying hard to be here. There's some kind of effort involved in being patient. But when true patience is there, you don't even know you're patient. You're just present. Patience still means you're halfway, you're half there and half not there. You're practicing to be patient. Okay, I'll be patient for another half hour, but then I will have had enough. That's practice. So it's wonderful when these concepts are not really needed anymore. But there is a stage when they may be helpful. There is a stage when the affirmation on the bathroom mirror is okay. But there is also comes a time when you go beyond that. You wouldn't want to be staring at a signpost. If you want to get to Rome, you wouldn't be staring at a signpost for years that says Rome that way. And then there are the collectors of signposts. They have a whole bunch stored up and then compare them. Oh, this compares to that one and this tradition, and he said that and he said that and this. And if you become a collector of signposts, then it's hard to let go, because you have a precious collection. In a way, all teachings are signposts. And you don't need to even identify with any particular form of teaching. There can be certain traps on the spiritual path to identify with one particular form in which a teaching comes. And then it's, okay, I'm a Buddhist. And the other says, no, I'm a Sufi. And the other says, well, I'm a Zen Buddhist and you are Theravada. Zen is actually superior. And so, again, images come in and they can be obstacles when you identify. Ego on the spiritual path can creep in at any stage. So to look out, now ego means an image, a new image has formed again in your mind of who you are. Ego, is a very subtle thing you can observe in yourself, comparison. Ego likes to compare itself. Comparison is an ego device. So ego compares itself to others in a subtle way. And whenever ego is a feeling of inferiority or superiority arises as against others, both the feeling of, okay, I may not be as good as that person or as knowledgeable or as spiritual as that person, that's ego, or feeling I'm more spiritual than that person, I've been practicing for longer, or my tradition is better than that person's, then that's the superior ego coming in. Even to have an image of yourself as spiritual, that the ego goes into that. Trying to live according to an image in your head trying to be spiritual, to see yourself as spiritual, that's another ego trap. And then you become more unconscious in a way. Ego means unconsciousness has returned, and despite your meditation practice, then you find there are lots of things that, if you have an image of yourself as spiritual, then there are lots of things you have to deny that arise inside you, and that would be, if you looked at them openly, they would be telling you, oh no, you're not that spiritual. You have to push them aside. Anger, whatever comes up, if it no longer fits your self-image, you push it aside, and then it goes building up momentum like a boiling kettle, a boiling pot you have put the lid on, and the steam is building up, and then suddenly you get an outburst or a wave of depression. In Christianity, often they have tried to live according to what it's like to be a good Christian, trying hard, and anything that doesn't fit the self-image of me as a good Christian has to be pushed aside. And then you can't push it aside forever. At some point, the unconscious will again emerge and overwhelm you. As rage, as anxiety, as depression, a mood, dark mood suddenly coming in. And so presence is to live free of self-images, because that's mind, it's conditioning, free of needing some image to tell you who you are. You don't really need that. And this is why I said you learn from animals, although animals have no self-image. They are themselves. They act naturally, spontaneously, or rather life acts through them. They have, of course, the limitations of their particular form, and yet they are more deeply connected to the source than humans in their normal state. So that's again, that's why it's so helpful to learn to watch an animal. It doesn't live through a self-image. It is itself. It's the natural state. And what we are returning to is the natural, that's in India, they sometimes use that expression, the natural state that humans lost a long time ago. So that's wonderful. You're returning to that. So simply observe when some new self-image has formed, or some old self-image has returned. Look, so often be aware of comparison as an ego device. In a subtle way, you're feeling better than or not as good as. There's the ego. Better than, not as good as. Another sign that you're living through a self-image is defensiveness. Defensiveness arises when somebody questions your beliefs, questions a statement that you've made, doubts this or that you associate with your self-image. So observe defensiveness coming in. And you're always defending an image, because who you truly are doesn't need any defense. It's so powerful, cannot be attacked, it's totally beyond anything that could be injured or attacked in any way. It doesn't need any defenses. So observing when it happens, when you observe it, you're not no longer trapped in that unconscious movement. When you observe that an image has arisen in your mind and you've become identified with that, at that moment, oh, that's the, again, the unconditioned has come in. You're suddenly aware of it. When you're observing that you've become defensive about a position you have taken, it may even be something spiritual. My mental position, it's, you've identified with a position, which means an image has formed in your mind of me, and that needs to be defended. Therefore, the Course in Miracles says, it has some wonderful statements, whenever you become defensive about anything, know that you have identified yourself with an illusion. Whenever you become defensive about anything, know that you have identified yourself with an illusion. But the knowing is not part of the illusion. That's the beauty of it. The moment you know that you have identified yourself with an illusion, the knowing is not the illusion. You have recognized the illusion, and in that knowing, you are free of the illusion. So the more illusions like that you discover in yourself, the better. Because every time you discover a mind pattern, an old mind pattern acting itself out, a self-image, defensiveness, grasping, clinging, the moment you become aware of patterns, the awareness or the knowing is not part of that. That's why it's so wonderful. The more you discover that's unconscious in you, the better. It doesn't mean that you have failed. Discovering it is, this is how it works. To recognize it. To recognize illusion as illusion is not illusion. You've recognized. The recognition is not part of the conditioned mind. The recognition is the unconditioned. It sees. It just sees there. So, and this is the wonderful thing that means you can afford the luxury of allowing whatever arises inside you to arise. You don't have to deny anything when we do this work, if you want to call it work. You don't need to deny anything, which you need to if you live through a self-image. Anything that doesn't fit the self-image is denied. But in this work, whatever arises, you allow it. Emotional patterns, mind patterns arise, and there comes the recognition as they arise. When I say allow whatever arises to arise, you might ask, well, doesn't everybody live in that way? No, they don't. The allowing implies that there is an awareness, and the awareness is not part of the conditioned. When I say allow, it implies there is a presence that observes the pattern as it unfolds, either in your head or externally as a behavior pattern when you're talking to someone. So, and just watch. The more you see, the more consciousness grows. The more unconscious patterns you discover in yourself, the more consciousness is growing. So it doesn't arise anymore to say, oh, I shouldn't be feeling this, I shouldn't have that thought, this doesn't arise anymore. The allowing of inner states, that's a wonderfully liberating practice. And then you know that there's no inner state that is actually you. No conditioned state is who you really are. That's why you are free to allow them. Otherwise, if anger comes and you identify with it and think, oh, I shouldn't be that. I've been on the spiritual path for so many years and I'm still getting all this anger. I shouldn't. Then you'd want to repress it or deny it or say, no, I'm not angry. I'm just I'm never angry. Don't accuse me of being angry. You are angry. That the typical ego interactions. Me unconscious, you are the one who is unconscious. And observe how mechanical defensiveness is. The mechanical nature, the condition, it arises almost like clockwork, almost automatically. Somebody pushes a button and the reaction comes. And when people know you after a while, then if they want a reaction, they just push the button. And they it's like a robot. A few months ago, I was walking in Stanley Park in Vancouver and by the pond. Just an example of, I'm always watching around me because one can learn so much by simply watching people. Now, I don't mean, animals, of course, are deeper learning, but you can learn about dysfunction by watching people. There was a man, an old elderly man, feeding the ducks with breadcrumbs. And then two youngsters, teenagers on bicycles, 16-year-old, came up and they were wearing a badge, some voluntary workers, ecological voluntary working brigade or something. And they talked to the man who was feeding the ducks and said, do you know that feeding the ducks is actually bad for them? Feeding them breadcrumbs because it fills up their stomach and doesn't give them enough nourishment. And he was feeding ducks. And then he said, yeah, I know. And he continued to feed the ducks. And then they said a bit more and then the defensiveness came up. He actually admitted that he knew it was bad for them, but somehow perhaps it gave him pleasure. Maybe it's the only interaction he has in life to feed the ducks. So the pleasure he derives from feeding the ducks was greater than knowing that it's actually harmful for them. So, and then he said, okay, well, no, I'm not stupid. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. I'm not stupid. So ego reaction came like clockwork, and he started talking angrily and defending himself. Didn't make much sense because you can't defend behavior that you've just recognized as wrong. But the ego doesn't care. It was an automatic defense mechanism, and he talked for several minutes, getting more and more angry, defending. Now, what was he defending? A mental position, a mental image, his ego. And finally, the youngsters who were perhaps were present, seemed quite present or well trained at least, they said, thank you for listening to us, bye bye. And then the man walked on, and I walked on, and 50 yards further on, I could see him, he was again feeding the ducks. But it's now, let's just see if. If presence had been there in him at that moment, let's replay the same scenario. He's feeding the ducks. The youngsters come, say, do you know it's harmful? And he's, perhaps the first statement was actually true. He said, yes, I know. And then he would say, I know you're absolutely right. It just gives me so much pleasure. I can't help it. I just feel that I need to feed the ducks, but you're right. I'll stop now. Or I'll just give them the rest of what I have, but I know you're absolutely right, but it's just, I love the duck so much and it gives me so much pleasure to feed them. No, that is his true power would be arising where the ego would have said, no, you become annihilated. This is weakness. Defend yourself. But if he had honestly expressed that, not needing to defend an image, then a true power would have arisen in him. His true power would have come forth. And to the ego that looks like becoming vulnerable, but it's not, it's true strength. And the whole interaction, the quality would have changed with it. There might have been a true communication between two human beings, the youngsters and the old man. There might even have been love. It could have been a wonderful encounter, but the ego didn't allow that. It needed to defend itself. People get more and more trapped in that. And this is just a tiny example. Now imagine somebody living like his whole life in that way. And most people are. Not so much perhaps everybody in this room recognizes a little bit of that, or sometimes more than a little bit, in their own lives, but most people in this room are not totally, nobody in this room is totally trapped in those ego patterns. Everybody who sits here, there's some already areas of freedom where you are go beyond ego, opening up, otherwise you wouldn't be here. The ego wouldn't have allowed you to come here, or if you had come anyway, it would have become too painful. You would have gone home by now. Now the interesting thing, when presence, the dimension comes in, and you observe defensiveness, then, oh God, there it is. And then sometimes through the simple fact of observation, you go beyond it, because that's the power that is where you don't need the defensiveness anymore. And then there's the shift suddenly. And always the mind will tell you, dangerous, defend yourself, protect yourself. So you learn by observing other human beings and then observing yourself, of course. Spiritual teaching or teacher, if it is true, says, okay, do you realize that you don't need to suffer anymore? Are you fed up enough with suffering? Or would you like to hang on to suffering? Anybody who's come here today has already suffered enough. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. So in a way, your suffering has been wonderful because it's taken you to this point. I know that I wouldn't be sitting here without having had dreadful suffering and pain. So it's taken you here. And now the message that comes is, further suffering is not necessary if you voluntarily step into the new state of consciousness. You choose the kingdom of heaven. Life doesn't have to drag you into it, kick you into the kingdom of heaven. It's painful. It did that to me. But now my job is to tell people that you don't have to wait for that to happen to you. Choose the new state, and you're able to do that. I wouldn't tell this to anybody, but not anybody comes here. If you come here, your level of consciousness, the new consciousness, is sufficiently emerged already for you to understand what I mean when I say you can choose to live in the state that is free of suffering. You can choose the state in which suffering is not possible anymore. Unhappiness does not arise. Not a state in which you close yourself and you become, okay, nothing can touch me anymore. Protective shell, nothing to do with that, because if nothing can touch, if you have a protective shell around you, that means all the beautiful and good things can't touch you anymore either. That's not what it is. It's a state of complete openness, a state of such intense presence that unhappiness has nowhere to cling to anymore. Because unhappiness can only cling to a mentally made sense of self, a little me, past, which moves continuously in past and future and continuously ignores the now. So the realization that in the now there are no problems and there is no unhappiness. And the unhappy me that lives through past and future dissolves as you become present. That's the teaching. That's the very same message that the Buddha gave 2,600 years ago, and a few people got it. And then misinterpretation started, because the mind started getting in there and say, okay, let's work this out. What does it really mean? How can we categorize it? How can we make a system out of that? So a heavy superstructure of mind stuff arose on top of the beautiful teaching. So that always happens. The mind tries to get in there, and so the heaviness of religion arises on top of the purity and simplicity of the original teaching. And this is the simplicity of the original teaching. We are going back to that. Freedom from pain is possible now. Now, first that means you understand how pain arises. It arises by not being present to this moment, by running away, by fighting, by denying, by running away internally from what is. So that's how pain arises, always. When you accept what is, the new state of consciousness immediately is present. So you can't separate acceptance of what is from the new state of thoughtless awareness. The moment you fully accept what is, the new state of thoughtless awareness is present. The whole mind stuff is resisting what is. Its very existence, the very ground for its existence, is the continuous state of resistance to what is. So resistance to what is and the old consciousness go together. So our practice is to not resist what is and thereby access the power of life. And yet, that may not immediately free you of all pain and suffering, because humans have been in that state for many thousands of years, and there is an energy field of pain that every human being inherits simply by the very fact that you are born into the human condition, into the unenlightened, painful human condition, in ultimately mad human condition up to this point. You are born into that, so every human being has a share of human pain that comes even from as you are born into this world, you're already born with a burden of pain. So this is a very important part of our practice and realization. This is not a facile thing of saying, okay, from now on we can all be happy. It goes deeper than that, and we are not running away also, we are not running away from the fact that in you there lives an energy field of residue of past human pain. On a personal level, pain from childhood that leaves residues, energetic residues, different things, painful things that happened to you in childhood, and of course far beyond that in time. But let's just talk from the level of your present existence in this form. Pain that is carried over from your childhood and beyond and leaves, doesn't go away completely, it leaves residues of pain and energy fields. Everything is energy. Then those energy fields get together because they feel they vibrate at the same frequency. So emotional pain gathers into one mass of pain, contracted energy that isn't flowing freely, an energy of that I call the pain body that humans carry inside, an energy field of pain. And if you don't recognize that, no matter how much spiritual practice you do, and even what we are doing here, if you do not see, if you do not recognize how the pain body operates, it will trick you every time and you will lose consciousness through it. So I want to address it now. So first we realize there is an energy field of pain in me that may manifest either as turbulence, anger, heaviness, like depression, tightness, fear. Whatever way it manifests, it's not pleasant, it's painful, it's past pain residues, but very much alive still. You carry it inside, but you're not always conscious of it. And I talk about it briefly in one chapter of the book, so we go into it a little bit more deeply now, and now there's the added energy of presence that we take into the pain body. The pain body is sometimes dormant and sometimes active. It becomes active when you suddenly feel it very strongly, when it needs to feed on further experience of pain, as it always has to do regularly, like it's a little entity almost. It needs feeding temporarily on the experience of further pain. And you will know that this has happened when a relatively insignificant trigger produces an incredible outburst reaction of pain. A minor thing goes wrong, or somebody says something, or your partner does something or says something, and there's suddenly a deep, or even a thought comes in, and suddenly it serves as a trigger for an immense, the arising of deep emotional pain. At that moment, the pain body, this energy field, has come up out of its dormant state, it is ready to feed on more pain. It produces first two ways in which it, I haven't quite put it that clearly in the book, I'll explain it in the next book. There are two ways in which it produce, it feeds on the further, because it's all you can feed on. You cannot, the pain body consists of that energy of pain. It needs, please, where can I get more pain? It feeds on your thoughts when it's ready to rise up. It will control your thinking. It rises into the mind. And the mind, which is your thought activity, becomes aligned with the pain body. Every thought you think is destructive and painful. And the pain body loves it. It gobbles up the energy of every thought that you think, every destructive and deeply negative thought. It eats it up, so to speak. And it's having a good time. It's feeding. And at that moment, one way of putting it is, one could say that is the addictive quality of human pain. Addictive because it loves its pain. When the pain body has taken you over and has succeeded in pretending that that's who you are, all your thinking is completely aligned with it. And it's feeding on it. At that very moment, the least thing you want, the last thing you want, is to be free of pain. At that moment, pain is what you want, because at that moment you are the pain body. And anybody who tells you that if I came into your life at that moment and gave you this message that a life free from pain is possible, you would hit me over the head. Because the pain body would be there, and I would be talking to the pain body, and the pain body would be talking back at me. So the pain body needs to come in periodically, and you all have experienced it with partners, finding the ideal partner, and after a few weeks, realizing that there's another side to them, that periodically they become a little monster. And then thinking, oh, I must have made a dreadful mistake. You haven't. Everybody has a pain body, including yourself. But it's a bit more difficult to see the little monster coming up in yourself. Now, the pain body will use your thinking. It will feed on your negative and destructive thinking. It can go on. Now, how long the feeding time lasts of a particular pain body varies greatly from person to person. It could be a pain body that feeds very quickly. Could be an hour or two. Some pain bodies have a feeding time of several weeks. Even months, that's extreme. And in very extreme cases, there are some pain bodies that have virtually no dormant stage. They are continuously feeding and active, but that's more rare, but also happens. You sometimes meet people who are, and you look into their eyes and you can see the pain body is looking at you through their eyes, and they're waiting for an excuse to have more. They want you to give them a painful reaction. They want you to be angry with them. They want you to attack them. That's people who are totally possessed by the pain body. So, level one, pain body feeds on your thinking. Level two, pain body feeds, it might even predominantly use somebody else's reactions. In relationships, when the pain body is ready to arise and feed, it will provoke a reaction in your partner, or the partner does it to you, pushes the right buttons because it wants pain. The pain body loves the drama. This is why drama is an essential part of most relationships. The pain body needs feeding. And you could be saying, suddenly it comes in. At the slightest trigger, there it is. So it feeds on the other person's reaction, and that's where drama arises in the relationship. And it'll give me more pain, please. And the mind is aligned with it, so the mind will find wonderful ways of rationalizing why it'll add to it through heated discussions or shouting matches. So it's totally, and then the other person's pain body awakens, and the two feed on each other until feeding time is over. And the two pain bodies subside, go to sleep, digesting food. And then the relationship for a while is harmonious again. And then the cycle starts again. So, pain body feeding on thinking, pain body feeding on other people's reactions. Now, I mentioned the unhappy me, a mind pattern that people are identified with, an unhappy sense of self. This mind pattern, when the pain body is active, becomes amplified. Its energy, the energy of the unhappy me, when the pain body moves into that mind pattern that already has been telling you your life isn't good enough and so on, and you may not make it, and what's it? Life has passed me by, and so on. Now the pain body moves into that mind pattern, and its energy gets amplified 10 times, 20 times, 50 times, 100 times. In other words, the unhappy me, when the pain body arises and flows into that mind structure, the emotion flows into the mind structure, the unhappy sense of me becomes dreadfully unhappy and loves its unhappiness, because that's what it consists of. Now, all that it is not a foreign body that lives in you. It is, there's nothing that is not life energy. Even the pain body is life energy, except that it isn't flowing freely. It's got stuck somewhere. And when energy gets stuck and cannot flow freely, pain arises. Like a river, if a river cannot flow, the water accumulates and pressure accumulates. But it's really, it's beautiful life energy. The water is still beautiful, but there's pressure accumulating inside. That's what the pain body is. Now, as we bring presence, this consciousness, into the pain body, it can no longer fool you into completely identifying with it. The presence, as the pain arises, from now on, many of you are already practicing that, pain arises, the pain body comes up, and at that moment you will recognize it as the pain body. That's the beginning of freedom from it. The recognition, when it comes, slight trigger, provocation, even a thought, deep pain arises in whatever form. In some people it's very active pain, active aggressive pain. In other persons it's a passive form of pain, poor little me victim pain. Doesn't matter which pain bodies have different qualities in different people. It may be turbulence or heaviness or tightness or constriction. It doesn't matter what it is. As it arises, you will know there is a witnessing presence, and you watch. Oops, there's the plain body. And you feel the energy field of it in your body. Often you can feel it in the solar plexus or stomach area, sometimes in the belly, as a dreadful sense of, oh, heaviness, or some people perceive it as a big hole, some gaping hole inside. Or it may be intense anger. But whatever it is, if you watch it, this is why sitting here is so helpful, because the witnessing presence, which is part of this new state of consciousness, gets so much strengthened simply by sitting in this energy field. So the watcher will be there, watching the pain. So the pain cannot use your mind anymore. It cannot feed on your thinking because you're watching it directly. It cannot creep into your mind and then become an unhappy me. So all that's left of the pain is an energy field of turbulence or heaviness. But the pain has not become an unhappy me, an unhappy sense of self, of who you are. That's the beginning of the end of the pain. But our practice is allowing what is to be, and that also applies as long as the pain body is there in you, allowing the pain that is there in you also to be. That is a very powerful practice. So I'm not saying we are not fighting the pain, we are not even trying to get rid of it. You bring the consciousness, which is a very compassionate state of allowing what is. It's a very powerful state. It implies you are present as the one who is able to allow. You are the one who is able to allow the pain to be. You know you're not creating this pain at this moment because you practice accepting what is. So it's not pain that you are creating, it's old pain. You bring the acceptance to the old pain. This wonderful state, this powerful practice, it does not just concern what happens to you externally, allowing this moment to be as it is. It includes the arising of pain in the pain body. You watch it, feel it, allow it. So you bring presence into it. You meet, the presence meets the pain body. Here's the pain body, and there comes the silent space of presence. Okay. And you hold the state of presence as the turbulence happens. Then the pain body is not replenishing itself. You've cut the link between the pain body and your thought processes. It's not feeding on your thinking anymore. You're watching it. Now, the best time to catch it and watch it is as it first arises in you, when you first notice it arising, to immediately become very alert with every cell of your body and feel it. There it is. And stay alert. Stay present. Continue to watch. This is the beginning of the transmutation of pain. The more you watch, the less it can feed. It loses its energy charge every time you stay present as the watcher of it. It's not gaining new energy. In fact, it's losing energy as the pain body, but the very energy that was trapped in there as the pain body becomes part of the aliveness of who you are. Many people's life energy is, to a large extent, trapped in their pain body. They have little access to their aliveness because the pain absorbs so much of their aliveness, and it's all trapped in there, in a big, unhappy me. And nothing is flowing. There's no flow whatsoever. There's only a huge contraction. Many human beings are one big contraction. it's amazing. The egoic state is one big contracted nothing flows. And as the energy becomes freed that's in the pain body, there's an incredible increase in aliveness and vitality. And of course, pain goes. It will not go the very first time you do it. You will have to do it many times. Many times it will try to arise again, and it will arise. Many times you will lose it. You will lose yourself in it again. That's right. It's all part of this. There will be times when it will take you over again. And afterwards you remember, oh, there it was, and I missed it completely. You might have gone through 3 hours of drama with your partner, and afterwards you say, oh, that was the pain body. I missed it completely. That's all right. Next time, maybe you'll catch it and know that it's there. The good thing is that the pain body becomes actually your ally in your presence practice, because without it, very few people would have enough motivation to enter the new state of consciousness. Every time the pain body comes, until you know this fact, the pain body will trick you every time and you will lose consciousness every time. But now that you know this, whenever it comes, it becomes incorporated into your practice of presence. So the more often it comes, the better it is. You're lucky. If you have a strong pain body, you're lucky. It's good for your practice. It can become a great teacher. That is the most powerful part of your practice, is to work with the pain body and see how quickly the transmutation happens when it no longer is an unhappy me. It's simply pain. Not pleasant, but you can allow it, and there's an incredible intensification of presence every time you bring it to the pain body. Now, those of you who have very dense or heavy pain bodies will need more intense presence. Most people that I know who have gone to become almost free of pain, there are not yet many who are completely free, but they will be, are people who have had very dense pain bodies, because their motivation is stronger to be free.
This concludes session 2. Our program continues with session 3.